She is the Dean of the Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration and holds the Rain and Stanley Silverstein Chair in Professional Ethics and Values. Dr. Novick initiated research on bullying in Jewish day schools and published multiple articles on bullying and bully prevention. She introduced the Brave Bully Prevention Program that she developed collaboratively while at North Shore Long Island Jewish Medical Center to numerous Jewish day schools. Dr. Novick is a clinical psychologist who served for many years as the Director of Child Psychology at Long Island Jewish Medical Center, where she maintains a voluntary appointment. Dr. Novick's research, teaching, and clinical interests include childhood anxiety and trauma, positive psychology, social-emotional learning, parent engagement, and cognitive behavioral therapy. I am also delighted to introduce our technical facilitator, Eitan, who will be working with Dr. Novick and can be reached through our chat box should you have any technical difficulties. Welcome to all, and Dr. Novick, the floor is yours now.
Thank you, and I think that, Eitan, you're going to toss me the ball so that I can control the slides. Thank you. So I have to start by way of apology and say that as much as we can do in the next hour, I know that it's just going to whet your appetite and that you're here because I'm assuming, like me, you're passionate about children and about their social lives as well as about their learning, or that you've witnessed the impact of bullying on the children that are in your life and that you care about professionally or personally. And so you'd love to find solutions. But bullying is a complex issue. So here's what we will do tonight. And again, my apologies for all the things that we can't possibly do in just this first hour together. Tonight, we are going to get some clarity about what bullying is. I can tell you that not a day goes by without somebody calling me, talking to me, or telling me that bullying happened. And sometimes they're right, and other times it's really a misunderstanding of what bullying is. We'll learn a little bit about which children are at greater risk, both for being bullies and for being the victims of bullying. We'll discover the importance of bystanders, both for children and adults. We'll consider very briefly some of the formal options, but mostly of programming that's available. But mostly I want us to explore together the way that as adults, whether we're teachers or parents, we can make a positive difference. For each of us to be a change agent, armed with knowledge and tools, and to understand children's social struggles and support their healthy social development, that's my goal tonight. And I hope that you'll kind of join me in this crusade. Throughout our time together, feel free to use the chat feature to share brief examples of bullying or social conflict that you've seen, and I may be able then to incorporate your examples into the presentation rather than only use my own. You'll note that right underneath the list of attendees, there's a row of icons. There's a hand, a green check, and a red X. I'm going to ask us to vote now. So if you were ever teased or purposely excluded from something during your school years, raise your hand. Use your hand icon. If it ever happened to you that you were teased, excluded from something on purpose when you were in school. Okay, I see a couple of hands raised. Okay, hands down. Now you have to click it again for your hands to go down. If you have heard children call other children a name, raise your hand. Oh, wow. We've all, virtually all, experienced that. And now, again, if you click your hand a second time, it will go away. That's kind of putting your hand down. Finally, if you've heard a child use the word bullying when telling you about a social situation they experienced, either in school, your own child saying, you know, somebody bullied me, or that boy is a bully, please raise your hand. Well, between the three of those, I think virtually all of you raised your hand for at least once. Bullying has become an incredibly common experience. But let's take a minute to think what bullying is and isn't. And I'm going to ask, you can vote with a green check if you think this is bullying, and a red X if you think it is not. Moshe, look at my picture. And Moshe answers, it's stupid and it's ugly, like you. Click on the green check if you think this is bullying. Oh, wow. We have a lot of discerning individuals here. And most people are saying it's not bullying. We'll answer your question in a moment, because here's your next opportunity to vote. Is this bullying? Shira is right there. Shira is the girl in the red shirt off to the left-hand side of your screen. Shira is right there. Quick, let's go get a table. Make sure there's no room for her. Good idea. Use your green check mark if you think this is bullying. You are really a very sophisticated audience. Good job. Most of you agree that this is bullying. I'm saying good job, by the way, because this is social bullying, social exclusion, and it is the type of bullying that is most commonly missed in the definition by parents, teachers, and even by children. They don't recognize that this is a type of bullying. And the last one, we don't even need to vote here. This is really the picture that most of us have, the archetype of bullying, a big, powerful brute physically attacking a smaller, weaker person. In fact, bullying is defined as the deliberate abuse of power to cause harm to another person. So there are three critical elements here. It's not accidentally I dropped my backpack on someone. It's deliberate. There's an abuse of power. There's an imbalance here. And harm is caused. So if we go back for a moment to Moshe making fun of, I'll call it Aliza's picture here, well, it is deliberate. If Moshe is the most popular artist in the class, if Moshe does this daily, no matter what Aliza shows him, then we might change some of our votes and say, yes, it's bullying. It's a deliberate abuse of his power to cause harm. Clearly, in this case, it was. And here, we have an abuse of power to cause harm. There is a lot of aggressive behavior that we see in schools, but that behavior, as inappropriate as it is not necessarily bullying. Imagine Sammy, who pushes his way to the front of the line and grabs the last chocolate milk, leaving David chocolate milkless. Well, that's rude, and it's really not very nice, but it isn't bullying, because Sammy's intent here, Sammy's kind of modus operandi, is not to make David feel small. It's not to exert his power just because he can. It's to get chocolate milk. That kind of aggression is called instrumental aggression. We aggress because we want something. We want to get something. If we hurt someone in the process, again, it's bad behavior. It's not something we want, but it isn't bullying. Second example, Dina invites two girls to sleep over. She doesn't include Miriam, who's also her friend. Well, you know, maybe Dina's mother only lets her have two girls sleep over. You can't always include everyone. This is not, by definition, bullying. We can turn it into bullying, by the way, if we add to the story that Dina spends all Friday talking in front of Miriam about how much fun they're going to have over the weekend, and it's just too bad you can't join us. Now we've crossed the line from inappropriate, possibly socially aggressive, to bullying. Last example, during a game of dodgeball during recess, Mark and Jeremy have a fight about who is out, and quickly the entire grade splits into either Mark's side or Jeremy's side. This is, again, it could turn out to be a very aggressive argument, but it's not necessarily bullying. I will say that the only reason that it matters, because the truth is that as parents and as educators, we don't want children to be aggressive, no matter what, whether it's bullying or just being a brute or being a crass or rude, we want to eliminate or decrease the behavior. But the reason it matters is that let's imagine that I'm going to give you a fourth example here. Let's imagine that at recess, Joshua, going out to the swings, demands that Jacob give him the swing that he's swinging on. He says, I want to turn. You have to get off. You have to give me a swing. Well, if Jacob is on the last swing, he took the last swing, and there are no other swings available, then the solution to that problem might be to create turns, to create a system of sharing. If, on the other hand, Joshua does the exact same thing when there's a row of empty swings, but he says to Jacob, get off that swing. Who said you could swing? That's my swing. Now creating a system of taking turns is not relevant. It's not going to fix the problem. So understanding a little bit about whether the aggression is coming from a place of power or coming from the fact that there are resources here that I'd like to access that I'm not getting is going to have an impact on what we do. I'm going to look together with you very, very briefly at who bullies are and who victims are. But one caution here. All of this information comes from research on children who are very consistently involved in either bullying or being victims, not a child who does it once in a while. Because, frankly, given the incredibly common rates of bullying, ask any child, fourth through eighth grade, because those are the peak years of bullying, happens before and after, but those are the peak years. Ask any child if they heard today somebody called a name, and just as you all raised your hands, they'll all raise their hands. They're seeing it. It's really become quite common a behavior. So the research tells us mostly about those students who are and children who are regularly engaged in this type of behavior. And what we know is that bullies tend to come out of the group of children who are generally a little bit more aggressive in their strategies, who like to be in control and in charge, and who may be impulsive. Victims, on the other hand, tend to come from the class of children that tend to be reserved or shy and emotionally reactive. So think for a moment about what we talk about when we talk about temperament and how temperament, how a child's kind of preset factory wiring influences whether they're likely to become a bully or a victim. If you are an outgoing, verbally accomplished, bossy, I take charge kind of child, you're more likely, you're more at risk for engaging in bullying behavior. A child who is more shy and reserved, whose temperament is to be tentative, is less likely to be at risk for that kind of behavior and is, in fact, more likely to be a victim. Now, you may notice something unusual and interesting that's missing from the list of who are victims. You may notice, for example, that on the list of who the victims are is not that these are children who are short or exceedingly tall or who are learners with challenges or who have a particular physical characteristic. They wear eyeglasses or they have braces. The reason is that almost any child who has a physical, emotional, or behavioral difference will at one point in time be teased or joked about it. You can't see me on a webinar, but on a good day, I'm 5 feet tall. And I can tell you every tease and jibe and every taunt for short people. I certainly was called, munchkin, peanut, and shrimp in my day. But because I'm not a particularly emotionally reactive person, that when you called me those names, I was just as likely to laugh about it or, dance off happily into my little world. Whereas if I was an emotional child, like my friend Suzanne, who was just a shade shorter than me in school, if you talked to her about her size, she would run crying out of the room. You couldn't help but notice what it would take to get Suzanne upset. So who do you think the bully goes after? Because bullying is about power, children who react emotionally provide bullies with an indication that they have, in fact, exerted their power. And so they're at greater risk. A caution here, before you all run to your classroom or to your living room or your playroom and say, oh my gosh, my child's a bully or my child's a victim. First of all, everything that I'm going to talk about tonight about bullying does not hold up in families. Sibling relationships are a totally different ball of wax than our school and peer relationships. Secondly, virtually all children will engage in aggressive and, yes, even bullying behavior on occasion. And virtually all children will be the victim on occasion. The time for concern is when the behavior is happening in a fairly frequent and repeated way. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about how we help bullies or victims. We can, and it's a slow and difficult but not impossible process. But what I want to focus on is the larger and really the most important group that is a key not to preventing but to addressing bullying in school settings, and those are bystanders. 90% of all bullying is seen by other children, not necessarily by us. Bullies like to be powerful in the peer group. So it's really no fun to approach Josh on the swing and say, you get off that swing and give it to me, if the rest of the class doesn't see it or know it and know that you're powerful. So bullying often happens with a witness. Because of the advent of technology, witnesses no longer need to be physically present because children can tweet or Instagram or Facebook or IM their latest conquest and can spread the news like wildfire. We know that what witnesses do has a huge impact on whether bullying will continue, whether it will escalate or de-escalate, whether it's allowed to happen or not. That means that bullying is not an issue between a bully and a victim. It's a social issue embedded in a social climate. And so it's a little bit a thermometer or an indicator of the climate or culture or social dynamic of the larger group. It means we as adults have to consider the social rules and expectations that surround the children in our lives to think about, are we creating or contributing to an environment that allows cruelty, or are we setting up the standards that say we're equitable, we treat people equally and fair here? In fact, what the message that bullying sends is that some people are better, are more important, and are more valuable than others. And the antidote to bullying is really believing that we are, each and every child, B'Tselem Elohim, worthy and worthwhile and valued. So when we look at bullying in school settings and in communities, we have to realize that there are multiple contributors to the relatively high frequencies and high rates that we're seeing of bullying. And I have to say that it's a little bit sobering, having done some of the research myself on bullying in Jewish day schools, that our rates are not unlike those found in public school. The face of bullying is different in our schools, but the blanket rates are about the same. In our Jewish day schools, we have much less physical bullying, the one type of bullying. We have about equal amounts of emotional bullying, which is name-calling and teasing, but we have a great deal of social exclusionary bullying. You can't sit at my table, you can't be in my group, etc., that kind of bullying. And it is particularly painful in the Jewish community because we are a relatively small and insular group. So a child who doesn't feel that they have a makom or a place in their school doesn't have their Girl Scout troop or their Little League group where they can get a whole new group of children. Often, they're traveling with the same group of children throughout. So when we think about bullying in our communities, we have to realize that part of it is about the individual children who make up our communities, and that we do have some children whose temperament places them at risk. But we also have to think about bystander reaction. And what does the group do, whether the group is adults or children? What do people do when they see bullying happen? And finally, we have to think about the larger social climate. What are our unspoken and our spoken rules? What do bystanders do? And here I'm going to ask you to use the chat room feature. I'm going to read both of these. Choose either one and type into the chat room what you think either Danny or Yael would be likely to do as bystanders in this situation. Think about the children in your life and what they might do if they were in this situation. The first one, while at his locker, Danny overhears Eitan call Gabe a loser and teases him about his ball-playing skills. Danny is likely to do what? Type your answer into the chat room. Or the second one, Yael sees Eliana run crying out of the lunchroom. She can hear the girls at the table next to her talking about the party this weekend that everyone is invited to, except Eliana. Yael is likely to, and we have some answers already. You know, people, the children are likely to do nothing. They're likely to join in, unfortunately. Danny might even repeat what he has heard, not just join in, but Danny might go to somebody else and say, hey, guess what I heard about? Spreading the rumor. And Javi, you made a really important point. It depends on the character of the child. They might do nothing. They might join in. They might stand up for the victim. You know, the interesting thing is that if we were to translate these into adult situations, how often do we overhear someone doing something or see somebody doing something that we feel is really not right or not appropriate? We're adults, and how often do we step up and do something? So it's we have to be humbled when we realize what we're asking children to do to make a difference. I think I said this already, so I can skip this slide. And we have to realize that adults are bystanders too. And here, I'm going to challenge you, what would you do in these situations? Think if you're a teacher, you're going to respond to the pink one, and if you're a parent, you're the green one. So teachers, you've assigned partners for a report, and when Yoni hears that he's going to be paired with Evan, he makes a face and he moves his chair away from Evan. Parents, you're driving a group of girls in carpool when you overhear Devorah tell Jessica that her shoes are stupid like her. No wonder no one sits with her at lunch. Okay. You were very good at telling me what you thought the children would do. Use the chat feature. Tell me what you would do in these situations. You're the grown-up here. I don't see any answers, guys. Pull the child aside, okay, and ask what the problem is. Talk to Evan privately. Okay? Thank you, Rivka Malka. Oh, I like Javi. We're all going to smile and be happy with our partner. So we have some, and then come up with a way to solve the problem. So we have some adults who are weighing in on what they would do. But I'm going to challenge you even further to really think, as we talk a little bit more tonight, about your role as a bystander and realize that when we do nothing, if we're driving that carpool and we say, you know what, Devorah's not my child, Jessica's not my child, I'm just driving the carpool, I can't get involved or I'm not getting involved, we have to think about what are we teaching the children in the carpool. We're teaching them that this behavior is acceptable to us because inaction is read by children as approval. I love, Shifi, thank you, that you pointed to the rubric and that working together was part of their grade, that they had to be able to work together. And Rachel, thank you also for first addressing Evan's feelings and tell Yoni that it's not okay. He can redo the situation. You're absolutely right, Rivkamata. These are opportunities to practice what we preach, and also the opposite is true. These are opportunities for hypocrisy, which will undercut and erode our ability to be the social role models that we need and want to be. We can't afford to be telling children, you have to be nice, you have to stand up for others, you can't stand idly by when someone is hurt and have them see us, adults, not step in. So the key elements to bully prevention, and really, quite frankly, it shouldn't be called bully prevention. It should be called bully reduction. I'm going to get to that, Javi, about preventative, and an ounce of prevention versus is worth, I don't think a pound, I think it's worth several tons of cure. So thank you, Javi. We'll get to that in a moment. The key elements in bully reduction, or in addressing bullying for schools and for home, are really these four parts. We need, first of all, to be on the same page in terms of our knowledge. We need children and adults to know what bullying is, what aggression is, what impact it has, how it hurts others. But knowing that it's there and that it's a problem isn't enough. We need to go the next step, and we need to share responsibility for addressing this problem. Then we need skills that are going to help us when we find ourselves in that situation. When I hear Danny saying that in the hallway, or when I see Evan hurt in that way, we need some skills. What can I do? And finally, we do need to think about rules and consequences when things don't go the way that we've planned or we want, even as Rivka says, as Javi said, even when we've put preventative measures in place. So let's look at before, during, and after. Before bullying happens, what might we do? The prevention question. When it is happening in the moment, and afterwards. Here, I promised you, there it is, an ounce of prevention worth tons of cures. Now, here is the problem. In our day schools, and Rivka Malka made the very nice point that we teach good mitos, and I think we it's rare for me to visit a school that doesn't have a MIDOS plan or a MIDOS curriculum or a MIDOS bulletin board. We do teach it. But our day schools have so much curriculum and so little time that we really can't afford to have single-purpose lessons. We need to double dip. We need to look at our reading curriculum. We need to look at Parshat HaShavua. We need to look at both Judaic studies and English subjects and say, where at every moment of the day, at every class, are we teaching these midot in hands-on, these social skills in practical, applied ways? If we are going to assign a report, whether it's science or collaborative work in math, have we taught children how to be a respectful partner? Have we taught them how to be a true chavruta, a chaver, a friend? We also have to recognize that it is much easier to learn lessons in calm, non-intense settings. I'll tell you a funny story that years ago, I was doing a bully prevention program at a very large middle school, and I was about to break probably 150 students, none of whom I know, they're all strangers, into random groups they were going to work together with for the day. They were just going to count off by, 10 or 15, and then they were going to be put into their groups. And I did what I always do when I put students in groups, which I said, we're going to break into groups. You don't have to marry the people in your group. You have to get along for today. I hope everybody's going to be okay with their groups. Can I see a show of hands if everyone's going to be okay? Everybody raises their hands. Everybody counts off in this auditorium, and when the last person counts off, 150 students in unison erupt into the phrase, these are good groups. And I was in shock. 150 students in unison? I didn't ask them to do that. And all of the teachers in the school are laughing. And I said, could somebody clue me in on the joke? And one of the middle school teachers said, we have a rule here at Yeshiva XYZ that whenever groups are assigned, the only response that students can make is, these are good groups. So they had invested, this school had invested in a prevention strategy. No eye rolling, no complaining to the teacher. The only thing you can say about a group is these are good groups. But they were teaching the lesson in, yes, it is parroting Rivka Malka, but they, and the students were doing it kind of as a joke for me. But the fact is that it did create kind of an esprit de corps, a collaborative spirit, and it had shut down over a period of years the kinds of dissension that was happening when students would complain about their group assignment. Other before principles include use yourself. This is not an area where you can or should be an unbiased, innocent bystander. You can be incredulous at something that you hear in the news or that you see in front of your eyes. You can be disappointed and hurt that people would act that way in your class, in your carpool. I used to drive boys in my carpool. I only have sons. And I would say, you're hurting Miss Novick's ears. My delicate ears don't like that kind of talk, gentlemen. Please, in Mrs. Novick's carpool, could you be careful of my sensitive ears? Using a little bit about, you know, using a little bit of humor, but making it clear that there were things I found offensive and that I didn't want to hear in my carpool. Finally, we need to know that we never know the right dosage of our intervention, and so we need to dose frequently. We need to repeat whatever preventative lessons we are using in an ongoing way, and very importantly, to capitalize on teachable moments. I also was in a classroom once, and a student came in late because she was in a wheelchair with a cast on her leg that the cast was out straight. She could not put her leg down. She had one of the wheelchairs where the... Well, not only did she have to be integrated into a group project, but because of the angle of her leg, it required moving chairs and moving desks and figuring out where she could sit. And I have to tell you that the group that she was assigned to was unbelievable about making accommodations that were really quite challenging, because the group was working on a project that involved arts and crafts and getting her access to everything. Not only did I use that teachable moment, which really it was a gift to me, to talk about how unbelievably caring the group was, but I also used it to ask the entire class, would it have been as easy to be welcoming to a student who was late because, I don't know, you know, their carpool was late? Like, what made it so easy or compelling? And why is it so easy for us to help out a student who we can see her pain, her legs in a cast, we can see what she needs, but aren't there times when we can't see what people need? But still, they might need us. So it's looking for those opportunities to explore them. I love Rivka Malka's idea to write one thing a child likes about every classmate at the beginning of the year. I don't know how well they know each other. Depends on your school. I do know one teacher I saw as a Purim exercise. Her Mishloach Manot, her Shalach Manis, every child got a cardboard cutout of a basket, and every other child got two cutouts of candies, which they had to inscribe with something that somebody in the class does well and gift to that child. So they had to write on their Hershey kiss. It wasn't a real kiss. It was a mock-up of it. They had to write on it, Moshe, you have great penmanship. Yossi, it was boys, so you can imagine what they wrote. You know, I think it was fourth grade boys. Yossi, you're the fastest runner. Moshe, you have cool sneakers. But they had to give each other compliments to put into their Mishloach Manot basket as their goodies, as their treats. Consider content. And again, I've got the teacher's questions on in the green and parents' questions in the pink. But they're really both questions about what are we using as our, you know, what are we doing in our time with our children? Are we reading the books that and assigning things that support the development of the knowledge and skills and affinities that promote the kind of social skills and social climate that we want? Are we giving, as teachers, group assignments? And in those group assignments, are our rubrics, our grading, our scoring, including how good a collaborator you are and how good a partner you are? As parents, what books do we read with our children? With the advent of digital searching in a library, you can ask your child librarian in your local library to help you if you don't know how to do this, but you can search picture books for books about friendship, for books about bullying, for books about caring and empathy. Think about the movies and videos you see. Unfortunately, particularly in the preteen years, movies and videos are fraught with put-downs, with the humor of pratfalls and cruelty. And the illusion is that, you know, it's done and then 30 minutes later we go to commercial and everyone's friends again. So I think we have to really help children understand in small clips of movies. I happen to like watching a two-minute clip of Harry Potter, stopping it and asking children, how do you know that Draco is not being nice here? How can you tell that Harry's feelings are hurt? And Nava has an excellent idea here. Books, whether it's kindergarten or high school, books are an amazing vehicle to analyze how people are feeling and how their feelings are affected by the actions of others. I think we tend to do this much more in the early childhood years. And again, I had an amazing teacher who actually brought in different pairs of shoes. And depending on the book that they were reading, would say, let's stand in the shoes of Curious George's man with the yellow hat. And let's see why the man in the yellow hat is so angry. Let's stand in his shoes and see what it's like in his shoes. Now let's stand in the shopkeeper's shoes. Why is the shopkeeper upset with George? What a brilliant, concrete way to teach empathy, right? Think as parents, what are our discussions focused on? Do we greet our child at the end of the day with questions about how much homework, what did you get on the test, have you done your book report, what's in the science fair project, or do we ask, who did you sit with today at lunch? Did you invite anybody new to join your group? How did you work out that game that you were going to take turns and give everybody a turn with? Did that work out? We have to show our children that these are parts of their lives that are equally important to us as are their academic prowess. Teachers, how are we using group learning? How do students respond when a peer makes a mistake? What shared responsibilities are there in our classroom? Do we know that this is our shared space and we all have to take care of it? Have we clearly communicated that in our classroom we treat each other with respect and that, as someone said earlier, that it's not just empty words, but that we really live it in our room? And at home, we can also teach shared responsibility. We can teach the notion that, you know, this is our family, and if one person does things that upset another, then it's all of our job to help people feel better. Do we teach our children through charity projects that we engage in or that we co-opt their engagement with to have empathy and to think about the needs of others? Have we created and communicated rules about social situations? Have we said, here's what your job is, Miss Bat Mitzvah Girl or Mr. Bar Mitzvah Boy? Here's your job when you're the Baal Simcha. Here's your job when you're a guest. Here's what your responsibility is when you have a birthday party to your guests, to your friends, to the people that you can't include because I won't allow you to have 37 girls at the slumber party. So here's what you have to do at school. You have to be quiet and not talk about it so no one feels bad. Now, what about when bullying happens? I've already made the point that as adults, we need to do something because if we do nothing, it's seen as if we're a bystander who agrees with what is happening. At the same time, we have to think about doing no harm because often the obvious thing to do is not necessarily the best. We might want to stand up in front of the class when Danny is being, or I forget which one was teasing, whether it was Danny or Evan, but when Danny is being dissed by Evan. We may want to stand up in front of the class and say, how dare you boys not be nice to Danny? Now, because of that, you've all lost recess. But that is not necessarily going to protect Danny. That actually might further identify him as the poor miskin, the poor kid in the class, the nerd who nobody wants to be with, and it also may cause retribution. So we have to really think carefully before we intervene. We have to stay calm and be the grown-up. We cannot turn into bullies ourselves. We cannot threaten bullies. We can't say, you think you're going to hurt that kid? Well, I'll hurt you so bad. That doesn't fix anything. Some potential responses include removing the victim or the bully, dividing them, sometimes protecting the victim in a quiet and indirect way, like saying to Danny, Danny, can I ask you a favor? I need 10 copies of this in the office. Could you go to the office, please? I know you're so careful and responsible. I need somebody who I know is going to get this done right. Danny, would you do this for me? Take it to the office, get 10 copies. Mrs. Lazar will do it for you. Thank you. Now that Danny's out of the room, first of all, if Danny is going to cry or appear upset, you've protected him from the eyes of others. You've perhaps built him up by giving him the job. You've also now enabled a conversation about what just happened in the classroom without embarrassing Danny. So that's possible. We've already heard suggestions from others, and I agree, about private conversations, not doing things in public where there's the risk that we might blame the victim or have him feel that somehow he's responsible. Now, for parents, this is a very, very challenging piece, because when your child comes home and for the 10th time says, they grabbed my backpack, they took my snack again today, we tend to go into, Columbo mode, for those of us old enough to remember Peter Falk as Columbo. We start asking questions. Well, where did you have your snack? Well, how come you didn't put your snack in that pocket, in the inside zipper in your knapsack? And didn't we say you weren't going to take your snack out until it was at the lunchroom? The victim feels at that moment like they did something wrong. So parents or teachers, before you ask questions about what happened, make sure you start with a statement along the lines of, no matter what you did, I want you to know that no one has the right to take your snack. And it was wrong what they did. And it's not your fault. But since we can only work on what you do, what we do, we can't work on other people, let's see if we can't figure out a way to make this work better. So I'll ask you some questions. But remember, what they did was wrong. It's not what you did that's wrong. Don't assume, by the way, that all adults will share your views. So if either as teacher or parent, you're about to get on the phone and call Mr. and Mrs. Bully to tell them about the horrible behavior of their child, don't expect that they're going to say, oh, we're so sorry. We'll send our son with extra snack for your daughter tomorrow. They may say, well, he likes devil dogs. He's going to grab them as long as she has them. That's what we taught him. Go for what you like in life. And unfortunately, you will meet people in the world who think that bullying is absolutely okay. So what if, even in spite of our best efforts to prevent and to intervene, bullying happens? What do we do then? Well, we've already addressed these first two. Realize that it's not a lost opportunity. Don't think about it in terms of, oh, I missed the chance to deal with it. It happened already. I can't do anything about it. You can always loop back, reteach lessons, put new rules in place. And very often, in general, if bullying is happening, we need to put more eyes, more hands, and more heart in the game. We need to increase our adult presence and our supervision in those situations. Teachers, we can use current events, videos, our curriculum to underscore messages about something that just happened and about what we want to happen in the future. we can think about what in our class needs adjustment in the class climate. I'm thinking of a sixth grade teacher who, no joke, she had her students sat in tables. You know, they had their chairs moved together in tables. And one day she came in to find that a la the Survivor show on TV, one table had decided they were going to vote a student off their table. They had actually brought in an urn, and they were putting their votes in it, and they were voting who's going to be voted off the island, so to speak. Well, God bless that teacher. She closed her door. She said, everybody, put down your pencils, put down your books, bring your chairs into the middle. We need to talk, because this isn't the kind of class I want to teach. This isn't the way we work together. And so she had to consider her rules and her class climate and make adjustment. And, you know, finally, for educators, get help. If you're not sure how to handle something, talk to other people in the school, beyond the school, to think about how you can make a difference. I'll get to Oria's question in a moment. For parents, keep in mind that discussions may be better when they're not a lecture, but when they're indirect. If I sit my child down and say, I understand you were mean to somebody today, don't we get a pretty defensive, no, I wasn't, they're stupid, I shouldn't, I don't mind, you know. But if we can be more indirect, if based on a book we've read together or an article that we saw in the newspaper, we can say, you know, I was reading something about this happening in schools. Did that ever happen in your school? What would you do? Have you ever been in that situation? That can be more productive. Consider rules and consequences carefully, and remember that we can't mandate emotions. We can't make our children like someone, but we can say that there's certain behaviors that we find unacceptable. So Oria is asking a question about, can I address things in reference to cyberbullying? And I have to say that cyberbullying would take us, you know, at least another hour. But here's the quick statement about cyberbullying. We know that in the online technology environment, we have a degree of anonymity that makes all of this worse. It makes it worse on multiple levels. First, because we are our worst selves when we're anonymous. We're more likely to act unethically, cruelly, to do things more emotionally than we would do when people know who we are, when we can see them and they can see us. But the other problem with anonymity is that right now, for example, you assume that Dr. Ronanovic is speaking to you, and I promise you this is Dr. Ronanovic, but in truth, it could be an imposter. And so if I type something in the chat room right now, there's no way to know if it really me or did somebody else sign on to my account. And so children, I'm now finding, particularly in high school years and in the teen years, children are finding ways to hack into other people's identity and create all kinds of social tumult by pretending to be someone else. In an online school setting, Oria, there's not so much anonymity. You can see who's doing it and that they're not hiding it. That may be true in an online school setting, but it's not necessarily true on their phones or text messaging. There are ways, and our students are always, because they're younger than us, they are more technologically savvy than we are about hiding themselves. And by the way, even though it shows as coming from your phone number and coming from you, the fact that you're not face-to-face is disinhibiting. It allows people to do things that they wouldn't do in person. So I'm going to open to questions in a minute, but before I do, and perhaps we can get to more of the cyberbullying and the online piece, I want to just wrap up by considering the power that we have, whether we're parents or educators, and many of us are both. And that I'd like to suggest that we keep in mind these three ways that we have to use our power for the good. we have to think about making sure that our children see that we value, that we live, and that we teach caring social responsibility. What do I mean by that we value it? Our children know what matters to us by what we give airtime, by how much we talk about it at our Shabbos tables, and where it is in our curriculum. If we are spending 99% of our time on reading, writing, and arithmetic, on Rashi script, and on Mi Amar El Mi, not that that isn't important, please, it's critical. Our Jewish literacy is critical to our continuity as a people. But we have to give equal play. We have to find a way while we're teaching Rashi, while we're teaching 2 plus 2, while we're teaching chemistry, we have to find a way to at the same time say how you treat others is just as important to us. Think of the chemistry teacher who once said to me, you know, after hearing this talk, I'm doing a lesson on emulsifiers, and I think I'm going to challenge the 7th grade students after lab today to think about how they can be social emulsifiers. In our school, we have oils, and we have waters. And how can each one of us take responsibility to occasionally be the soap that brings people together? I thought that was brilliant. It's a brilliant way to show we value this along with our curriculum. Second, as we already heard from one of the participants who so beautifully expressed that we really need to make sure that we live this, that we do it, is that we have to be walking, talking exemplars. We have to live social caring and kindness. We have to live empathy, and we have to live responsible social citizenship. We can't be quiet, silent bystanders if we want our children to be more. And finally, we have to teach, whether we're professional educators or parents who are not paid but are our world's best teachers, we need to be teaching very directly how to be a friend, how to say a kind word, how to help someone who's hurting, how to, if it doesn't feel right to confront a bully, how can we perhaps walk up to a victim and put our arm around them or say a kind word or offer to do homework with them tomorrow. We have to teach our children how to do that and how to be kind. I want to thank you all so much for your ideas, for your participation, for your great comments in the chat section. I'm going to respond to some of the questions in the chat session, and then Sarah will also, if you want to raise your hand, Sarah will unmute you if you want to ask your question out loud. But if you want to type them in, I'll answer questions now.
Before we take questions, I just want to thank you for that wonderful presentation. I know, you know, as parents and educators, it's very reassuring to know that there are actual action steps that we can take to support an environment that's physically and emotionally safe for all our children. And while everyone's kind of processing and getting ready to raise their hand and ask some questions, I just want to draw your attention to our next two upcoming Hidden Sparks Without Walls sessions. We have one next Wednesday evening for teachers, Getting Lior on the Guest List, Boosting Social Success for Your Students, and that's with Mindy Rosenthal, and not, I think, unrelated to this evening's
topic.
Not at all. And then we have one the first week in December for parents, a real winner, More Home, Less Work. Who couldn't love that, with Tzipporah Shuk. And obviously, please feel free to go on to our website and register for those. I'm also going to ask that when you receive an email regarding an evaluation for this webinar, that you just take a moment to fill it out. It really helps us to continue to meet your needs and to provide exemplary content in our webinars. So we could take some questions now. If you, if anyone has one, please feel free to raise your hand, and we will unmute you.
Sarah, let me just respond to Miriam's question.
Sure.
In the chat room, what would you consider a good consequence for bullying? So much of, you know, I'm going to give you a very facetious answer, which is a good consequence is one that makes a difference, and that works to decrease the bullying. And some of that really depends on what the situation is. I do think that sometimes the most important consequence is to increase adult supervision. And that in and of itself is a consequence, you know, for students to know that, for example, they can't, you know, have independent recess because they really haven't figured out how to do that in a way that they can respect everybody. And so, you know, from now on, recess is going to be structured or there's going to be more supervision. In some cases, the consequence is removing a privilege from a bully because literally, can a child, a student, go on a trip with other students if they act in ways that make other people feel unsafe? To me, a logical consequence is you can't, you know, be on the overnighter. You can't do this if people are not feeling safe around you. And, you know, the difficulty is that these are very hard consequences, and it's hard not to have them come back and hurt the victim. You know, I've seen so many well-meaning schools say, you know, we're not going to let Danny play in the basketball game because he bullied Yessie. But Danny's the lead player, so now the entire school is furious at Yessie. And they blame Yessie. And so what was meant to be a consequence for Danny actually re-victimizes the victim. For that reason, by the way, I almost always tell parents of victims not to demand particular consequences, not to demand that the school tell them what the consequences will be for the bully, because often the consequences will be subtle. They may be unseen. One of the most effective consequences I ever saw was a school that met privately with a middle school female bully and said to her, she was an honor student, she was in line to be the valedictorian of the middle school graduation. They met with her and her parents privately and said, basically, we see the negative impact and influence you are having in the grade. It is undeniable and it is obvious to us. We have read the charter of the National Junior Honor Society, and we will not support your nomination if this behavior continues. You also will not be allowed to be valedictorian of the school. We will not share the reason with anyone. This is private. Your fate is in your hands for the rest of the school year. It's your choice whether you are going to be a positive social leader or continue to be a negative influence in our school. The girl turned it around. Nobody knew. It was a consequence that was perfectly executed. It was in the context of a very strong relationship with a school counselor, and it was, you know, brilliantly done. And, you know, she didn't. Nobody knew that, and by the way, the parents of the victim were constantly saying to the school, why isn't she being punished? We don't see any punishment. You know, what are you doing to that girl? And the school said what punishment has been or will be forthcoming is between that girl and us and that girl's parents. We can't release that information, which is true. They legally can't tell you what they're doing to or with other children other than your own. But it is complicated. Russell is a 5-year-old bully, right? You said had to spend the day eating lunch, doing all the work at a table by himself. More work for you, but he got the message. Well, thank you, Russell, for putting in the time and the work, because you're right. None of this is easy. None of it is quick. And it does take huge effort on the part of adults. But I think it's an investment we can't afford not to make. And I always end every talk on bullying with this story because I don't want to end in a negative. I do the work of addressing bullying not because of the bad stuff, but because of the good stuff. Because when we get this right, when we teach empathy, oh my gosh, we're raising the next generation of leaders for our community and for our world. So a 6th grade group had finished a series of workshops with me, and their lovely teacher said, who would like to give Dr. Novick some feedback? And a sixth grader raised her hand and said, Dr. Novick, I went home after these workshops and I told my mother that I can't listen to her anymore. And I'm thinking, that's it. My career is probably over. No one will hire me ever again. But she went on to say that her mother had always taught her that when you see trouble, you stay away from trouble. But she went on to say that she now realizes after the workshops that if she sees a friend in trouble and she walks away, what kind of friend is she? And if she sees a human being in trouble and she walks away, what kind of human being is she? That's the eager, the essence of social responsibility. That's what our world needs. That's what the Torah teaches us. It's the essence of who we are as Jews. We just have to, unravel it in our children. We have to reveal it in our children. And I agree with Kamalka that we do have to be so empathic and so there for our students. And I think that the more empathy and respect we give our students, the more they turn around and give it to others. And the Jacqueline asked a question. Are bullying tendencies more common from certain kinds of homes? It's a really interesting question, and it's one that the literature is still a bit in a debate around. We do know that despite the fact that I said certain temperaments are more likely to lead to, you know, a child being bullied, like it's very hard to be a bully if you're quite shy. There's fairly strong evidence that bullies have seen bullying happen and seen it work or pay off for them to engage in it. Imagine, for example, if you are a child with a really bossy temperament and you're very, very aggressive, but you're from a home where when you do that, your loving, caring parent says, no, Simcha, you can't grab things from your sister. You'll have to go sit now. You can't have that toy. And no, Simcha, you can't eat all of the cake by yourself. You have to leave some for everyone else. If you've witnessed and learned, despite your temperament, that this isn't going to work in your environment, then you don't continue on with that behavior. If, on the other hand, not only does your parent, you know, throw up their hand and say, oh, there goes Simcha again, grabbing and hitting, what can we do? But if your Simcha also sees that when mom goes to the dry cleaner and they don't have the clothing ready, that she says, threatens that dry cleaner within an ounce of their life and says, you're going to be sorry you treated me like this. And when they're out at a restaurant, dad berates the waiters and, you know, mom and dad bully each other or teachers in the school. If that's what Simcha sees, then yes, he's more likely to grow up with a belief that this is the way of the world and it works and it's okay. So there are certain households where it's, yes, it's happening. And it doesn't, by the way, it's not usually that the child has been a victim of bullying in their household. It's that they've seen in their household that bullying happens and it's okay. It's allowed to continue.
All right. Well, I think we all have a lot to digest and process this evening. And I want to thank everyone again, Dr. Novick, Eitan, all our participants, and of course, the generous donors that made this evening possible. I'd also like to, you know, I look forward to speaking with you all at future webinars, and I will wish you all a good evening. Thank you so much again.
Have a good night, everyone. And you do have a slide there that had my contact information. I wish you all the best.